Tonight on The Preposterous Gamer, did somebody say Game of the Year 2014? I didn't think so, but that's what you're getting. All that and not much else on The Preposterous Gamer. So, what's a game of the year? I mean, according Webster's Dictionary, it's the process of removing weeds from one's garden. Or maybe not. But actually, in a way it is. It's removing the weeds from, you know, the good games you saw over the last year. And I don't want to do a traditional game of the year thing. I mean, it's not really my style, because one thing I've learned, every game's good. And every game's bad. And every good game can be bad at the wrong, you know, when it's used at the wrong time. For example, if I'm in the mood for a shallow experience, you know, I just want to go in, button mash, kill a bunch of shit, I'm probably not going to load up saying like Monument Valley. I mean, it just doesn't, you know, work for the mood. So instead, I want to kind of break down more or less the games I played this year, and then go into which ones are right for the right mood. You know, when is it the right time for a game? Not all of these games are games from 2014, and some of them are quite old. They're all games, though, that I never played until 2014, or at least after a Game of the Year podcast of Infinite Lives last year, which was somewhere around the 20th to 23rd of December. I forget the exact date, but it was a while ago. So anything that I didn't have a chance to call a Game of the Year. I should also say, as I do this podcast, I was aiming to do this on Monday, so 2 days ago. Right now, it's the 31st of December, the final day of 2014. I wanted to do it on 29th, and, well, I was stuck playing Final Fantasy Mystic Quest for a live stream, and then I wanted to do it yesterday, and I was busy while also being very sick with a pretty nasty cold, and I'm still kind of sick, so let's see if my brain can work through all the cold meds. NyQuil, this show is all up to you. So, I don't know, start things off. I wanted you to look at a bunch of games that I wrote down at random that I did just playing for fun or on Indie Showcase, but not the games I did on Infinite Lives, Infinite Debts. I want to get into that in its own little subsection. So, first game I wrote down, might as well go in the order of the list I have in front of me, and this is not an order of how good they are. These are just games I played, and I just want to give a short little description. You know, if you're thinking of picking up something on Steam sale, or you got some Amazon gift cards for Christmas, I know I got a ton of those, which are always a good thing. I just want to give you some ideas of what games are out there. So first off, Transistor. This was the follow-up, well, I guess follow-up, but it's not really related to Big Huge Supergiant, yeah, Supergiant Games. This is a follow-up to their last one was Bastion, which was a fucking phenomenal game. Transistor, what I wrote down on my list, fuck this fuckbag of a game. So that sounds pretty harsh. Here's my problem. The game was glitchy as hell for me. On some people's computers, I guess it worked good, but it wasn't optimized for all hardware when it was released. So I had a glitchy experience, and I saw more crashes to desktop and a few blue screens of death. I tried to stream the game. I thought my streaming setup was bad, and that's causing crashes. But no, that game when it came out, glitchy as shit. I don't know if they patched it, but I had such a bad experience with that that I don't even want to touch it again. It had a weird turn-based real-time strategy RPG vibe that, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but that game does not play to my idea of a good game. So, going on to RPG trail, from there, we had South Park, The Stick of Truth, which, oh man, you know, there's one thing when you have low expectations. It's another when you have low expectations and you're blown away by a game. Just makes it so fucking good. So, South Park Stick of Truth, It pretty much, it's a licensed game, I mean, based on South Park cartoon, and it felt like a extra long, like, mini-series of South Park. It looked like South Park. Everything was voiced by the voice actors, except for your character, Douchebag, as Cartman calls him. And your character is unvoiced. You're pretty much like the silent protagonist. Area character voiced. The visuals look just like the cartoon. They look amazing. The RPG elements play out really well. You are essentially a kid who comes to the town of South Park. You're a new kid there. And the kids, in their make-believe, have warring factions. There's the elves, and there's the, I think they're knights or humans. So the elves, they're wanting the stick of truth from the humans, and the humans want the stick of truth because it's the ultimate source of power or something like that. I mean, that part of the story doesn't matter much, but you encounter, like, the goth kids, you encounter the guy who runs City Walk or Shitty Walk, the Chinese restaurant. You go Canada at one point, and all of a sudden the game turns into sort of a 8/16-bit RPG look. The game is just flat out awesome. It is the RPG for RPG fans who don't really want overly serious, self-serious experience. It's for people who want a fun RPG. It's for people who like South Park. Even if you don't like RPGs, but you like South Park, this game will hit every nerve just right for you. It's a brilliant game. Then there's Never Alone. Never Alone was a really cool indie title that I played. It was put out by the Cook Island Inuit Council or something like that. It pretty much is a way to retell the Inuit style of storytelling of myths and legends. And you get some really cool, documentary style, like cutscenes, or not cutscenes as much as things you could load up on your own. The story is really cool. It's about a girl who finds a fox, and they're out to essentially learn what the source of this blizzard that's hitting their village is. And the game is amazing. If you're a type who could go down a Wikipedia hole because you love reading about, like, history and mythology, this game's for you. The controls, it's kind of like Limbo. In fact, what I wrote is, like, a good Limbo meets a good BBC documentary about Inuit culture. On the downside, you could play it single player or co-op. If you play it single player, you switch off between controlling the girl and the fox. And the AI for whoever you're not controlling can be stupid. So you do have to fight the controls. But if you could fight through some bad controls, most of it's good. You get some cool elements. There's one part that made me think of Shadow of the Colossus, where you're climbing up the giant, trollish figure that's creating the blizzard. You've got different bosses that you have to solve through logic, not through, physical combat. It's a really cool experience. It's something that if you care about narrative in games, you should try checking it out. Next off is probably the last game I played of last year, but continued playing through New Year's into this year, The Tearaway, which Bree, my wife, got me a Vita for Christmas last year. And I bought The Tearaway because it looked real cool. And it's from Media Molecule, who, they always do me a good job. I have to say, it is my description. So I wrote down my list so I'd make sure I remembered games that were from earlier on in the year, because it's easy to forget what you played. What I wrote down was fun, joyful, and had a cool paper look with printable paper toys. One of the mechanics in the game is you can find objects that are not colored in, take a picture of them, and it'll send you a link where you could download those paper cutouts, either colored in or uncolored, that you could then print out and actually fold out in real life as origami. The Tearaway used pretty much every feature of the Vita. It used the front-facing camera to show your face. Anytime it showed the sun, your face was in the sun. Anytime the paper world of the Tearaway was torn apart, you'd see, like, yourself in the torn-away paper. You'd use the back touchpad to poke through the world. Your fingers would actually poke through paper and, you know, move objects. You'd tap the back of touch panel to, like, there's drums that you could stand on. And when you tap it, it'll drum you, so it'll give you a jump ability. It's a really cool game. It's the type of thing that really makes you feel like you're a kid again. Next off, Infamous Second Son. Okay, so it's better, in my opinion, it's better than Infamous 2. In this game, you have more powers, like, essentially, you have, I guess, spoilers, four different power sets. You start off with, smoke powers, which, essentially, it's ash and fire and stuff like that. Then you pick up Neon, which really looks amazing, really shows off what the PS4 visuals can do. You later pick up TV or video powers, which it's hard to really explain what that is. Let's just say it deals a lot with, like, summoning things that would be in an MMO, because you get the powers from a kid who's obsessed with MMOs and TV and video and all of that. Then at the end, you pick up Concrete, which is the power of the bad guys in the game. They have concrete abilities, so they could form big armor on themselves, launch blocks of concrete. It's a fun game. I have to say, it's based in Seattle, and that if you're a Seattleite, it might piss you off just for that, because this ain't no Seattle. But on PS4, it's probably best console exclusive I played on PS4. It's fun, and luckily it's short. It's only about 12 hours to complete everything, except for there are optional things that come up, like weekly puzzle quest things. But if you just go for all the collectibles, ignore the additional content that pops up for free every week, it's about 12 hours, which is, in my opinion, perfect time. It doesn't overstay its welcome. It's fun. I think if it lasted just a few more hours, I would have started to hate the game, like I did with Infamous 2. Infamous 2, I started to hate because it just lasted a little too long. And, I don't know, it's kind of cool. You play a member of an offshoot of a Salish Native American tribe, so you're not white, on a white, random, Cole McGrath or whatever his name was. You're Delson Rowe, who, you know, it ties in a little bit to the native culture around Seattle. Nothing too strong, but just enough where it feels like, okay, I'm not just playing random white guy protagonist. Okay, so after that, Monument Valley, which is one of the few phone games. In fact, I think it's the only one I'm going to be bringing up. Monument Valley is available on iOS and Android. It is a really cool game. It costs money. I think on iPhone it might be free. I'm not sure. On Android, it's $4. It's well worth it. It's a pretty short game. It deals with sort of Escher-style visuals, where walking on a wall or walking on a floor at one point will twist into walking on a wall, which, it's an interesting idea, and it really bends your brain a lot. So it's a real cool experience. And it pretty much controls just by using touchscreen. You could move where you could select where your character moves to, and you could drag and slide different objects to change how they look, how they behave, what's the floor, what's a wall, what's up, what's down. It's really, really cool if you like anything that's sort of a visual, like, I don't know, mind-bending type of experience. And the visuals are really tranquil. It's a great game. There's a $2 DLC that came out that had about as much content as regular game. I don't care what people say. There's a lot of complaints. Is $2 for DLC for a phone game? It's worth it. It's $2 with a ton of great content. Every part of that game is all great. There is no filler in this game. In fact, since it's the only one I'm going to bring up that's a mobile game, I have to say Monument Valley, my mobile game of the year, hands down. Then, up next on my list is Gang Beasts, which I just wrote down awesome multiplayer. If you check out our Extra Life archive from this year, we started our Extra Life this year playing Gang Beast. And it's a game you could play, I believe, up to 8 players. You're just these weird, pudgy, anthropomorphic blobs that you wrestle each other and fight each other and try and throw each other into pits or furnaces or something like that. If you have 4 people local, 4 or more, and you have the controllers for it, it is a great multiplayer game. It is silly. It is random. It is insanely fun. But you need to have, I'd say, at least 4 people around. I don't think I could do this 3 player. Speaking of, you should have 4 players, and you could go up to 8. Smash Brothers for Wii U, which I don't own it, but John got it, and I played quite a bit at John's place. It's the only Wii U game on my list, so let's call it my Wii U game of the year, because I don't have a Wii U. I hated Smash Brothers Brawl on the Wii, and it is definitely more balanced than Brawl, and it's wonderful play if you could get a GameCube controller. If you're using, like, the Wii U controls, or a Wiimote, or a classic controller, I can't really recommend it. But if you buy the adapter to use GameCube controllers, and you once liked Smash, but you no longer really feel it, this is a good one. This is what you need. Just make sure you've got a lot of people around. It could go up to 8 players. Might be a little too insane at 8. I haven't tried it. But playing it 4 player, that was a ton of fun. Really took me back to Smash Melee, which is my favorite Smash. And this comes so close to meeting Melee. It's a great revival. And let's call it my Wii U game of the year, because it's the only one I played on Wii U. Goat Simulator, which started as pretty much a joke game. And you control a goat with wonky physics. And wonky physics make that game really fun. I don't know if I'd pay more than like $5 for it, but if you love insanity, if you're a type who could get behind games like Surgeon Simulator, you know, and those with weird physics that make no sense, it's worth it. It's worth playing for a little while. And if you really want to see how much your computer can handle, it's a great test for that, because bending and destroying all those physics, you'll get to a few points where I know I could hear my GPU fan just cranking, because that game, it bended reality of my computer. It destroyed what my computer thought it was capable of. Next up, Destiny, which I would actually call my disappointment of the year. I was in the pre-alpha, I was in the beta. I never picked up the final game because everything that was in the alpha or pre-alpha and everything that's in the beta was the beginning of Destiny. And I played those so many times through, I just couldn't take it anymore. And the idea of what the end game was, with the grinding out loot from raids and mining away like mad to upgrade your equipment, because there's a soft level cap of 20, but then your equipment can bring you to higher levels somehow or whatever. And the game starts as a good first-person shooter. I can't see it turning into this grind fest. I mean, Bungie has some strengths, and the first-person shooter and the exploration is pretty cool in this, but no grinding. That's not what we want on first-person shooters. And then, next game on my list would be The Yogg. If you watched our Extra Life live streams or watched the archives, we played The Yogg several times. And it is an amazing game. It feels a lot like a choose-your-own-adventure. It's 4 characters. You could play it with 4 players or less, and you could have one or more people double down or triple down or quadruple down on what characters they control. You're told there is a horrible thing called the Yogg coming, and it will destroy your civilization if you're not ready for it. And you control these characters, telling them where to go during the day, and each character can essentially go 2 places per day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. and it'll boost their stats or lower their stats or unleash horrible plagues upon the world. And it is really, really cool. It's type of game. It's type of game that pretty much, if you like saying story heavy, really cool atmospheric look to it, and you like playing a narrative game with more than one person, so with friends, it is really fun. Each time when you have the Yogg show up, it'll determine, based on what you've done, how bad the world is afterwards. And you assign your people different jobs, like who's the leader, who's the builder, who's the healer. And it's all based off of stats that you built up as you're playing through. So if you kept helping out at the hospital, then you would have a lot of wisdom. And a lot of wisdom will make it where you're a good healer. Meanwhile, if you, let's say, hung out at the bar a lot, you might be a very charming person. And charm makes for a good leader. And maybe you had a lot of wealth. You could become the smelter, and you'll melt down your wealth to help rebuild the world. And then you have good, as in you survived and your society flourished. Bad, as in the Yogg wiped out all society and you're doomed to wander the wastelands. Or neutral, of you survived, but, well, you're not flourishing, you're barely making it. Each character, based on what they've done, will have different little side effects show up. It's just really cool. It's a great choose-your-own-adventure. So, speaking of story, next up, Always Sometimes Monsters. It's a awesome non-combat-based RPG, except there is a boxing game you do during the game, but it's all story-based. It's made in RPG Maker, so as long as you could get over that fact, because I know some people have issues with paying money for an RPG Maker game, but it's awesome. You pick who you are. You're a struggling writer who, at the beginning of the game, you pick who you are, and you pick who your romantic interest is, who will be your boyfriend or girlfriend. The game's open. If you want to be a guy with a boyfriend, awesome. If you want to be a woman with a girlfriend, awesome. If you want to be a guy with a girlfriend, great. If you want to be a woman with a boyfriend, awesome. So, as you play through, you're struggling to survive a year after this party where you signed up for, we're pretty much celebrating your huge book contract, which a year later you find out you failed, you're poor, your boyfriend or girlfriend from the party a year earlier is getting married, and you're determined to stop the wedding. And you'll make a lot of decisions that'll help determine where you'll end up. Can you get your love interest back? Can you survive? I mean, it's easy to just die in the game because you need to scrounge up money for food. You have to scrounge up money to get to the next town to try to eventually get to the wedding in time. You have 30 days, and you never feel too rushed, but you always feel like, oh no, like the sense of reality of, I'm trying to get something very important. Do I have a chance in hell of doing this? Really cool game. Amazing, like, morality system. Instead of, like, a game like Fable, where if you're good, you'll get a good sword. If you're evil, you'll get an evil sword. No, if you're good, you might end up not making it. This game, it teaches you sometimes being a bad guy is the only way you're going to actually survive. The only way you'll get money sometimes. Beginning of games, great example. So I was hired to do coat check at one of my friends had a band, and he said, hey, at the club, if you want, do coat check. Just don't steal anything. Well, if you don't steal anything, you'll get a little money for running coat check. If you steal from everyone's coats, you're going to get a lot more money. So being evil, being bad, is the benefit there. It is an amazing game. I love what they did with it. It is brilliant. And speaking of saying with a cool story, Broken Age, part one, that is, because part two is still not out yet. This was the Tim Schafer adventure game from Kickstarter, and it definitely has the Tim Schafer feel to it. It has a really cool story. It's a point-and-click adventure, so, oh no, for some people, it's hard to go back to the days of point-and-click adventures. For me, it's actually very hard to. But with that Tim Schafer sense of humor, that Tim Schafer style, it felt so great. You had the most random of characters. You essentially had two different stories going on, and you trade off what character you're playing. There's a boy who's in some sort of spaceship where there's no humans around. He's like a teenager who's being pretty much smothered by a computer AI that's determined to make him into the perfect young man. And meanwhile, he just wants free from this tedious existence where he can't even feed himself. The computer will send robots to feed him. On the other side, there's the girl who lives in sort of a more tribalistic of a village, and she has been chosen to be a sacrifice to some great evil monster. And unlike every other girl picked to be a sacrifice, she doesn't dig being set up to be killed. So she tries to break free of that role. And the way the two stories come together at the very end of part one is really, really cool. There are some parts that kind of drag, but in terms of being an adventure game, I could play it. And I have trouble going back to adventure games anymore. They're a little too slow and tedious with too many, like, confusing elements where it's like, well, I have the Wookiee nutsack. What do I attach that to? Or on a more serious way of looking at it, well, I picked up a birthday cake. Now where do I use it? Oh, I didn't understand. I used the birthday cake on the machine to make the machine run because the sugar in the cake can be burned for fuel for this machine. So in other words, it does have some of the adventure game, point-and-click adventure game trappings. Still, great fun. I'm looking forward to part two. I'm really hoping it comes out soon. I haven't heard much for a couple months. I want to say I got a Kickstarter backer in like notice a month or so ago saying stuff would be coming out like next month. But I haven't heard anything since then, so who knows? I really hope it does come out. Next up, Little Big Planet 3. It's Little Big Planet. Little Big Planet 2 was Little Big Planet. Little Big Planet 3 is Little Big Planet. You have a few different characters you could play as. Very rarely. The game doesn't take advantage of them all that much. And they'll have unique powers. Like there's the dog who could do wall jumps. There's the bird who could fly around. There's a big dude who can turn into a tiny dude. And when he's tiny, he could get in small areas. When he's big, he'll cause platforms to sink and fall down under his weight. I mean, in the end, what can I say? It's more Little Big Planet. They did bring in, even though it's not Media Molecule anymore, they did bring in that feel of Little Big Planet. The great British, like, narration and British voices that they're saying about some games where British voices just feel so right. And then the real cool thing is they essentially have all of the Little Big Planet 1 and 2 user-created levels in the game. Well, in the internet where you could connect to them and play them. So there's a ton of user content already. They threw in some, like, bonus mini-game type of things to help you learn how to program and have fun with it, which I never could get in programming on Little Big Planet 1 or 2. I don't think I'll do it on 3, but I can at least understand how to do it now. So, great game if you like Little Big Planet. The only downside is this is next generation. This is PS4. Well, this generation. Next versus Little Big Planet 1 and 2. So, considering I have it fully installed, you know, it's a digital download, why are the load times longer than they were on Little Big Planet 1 or 2, which were on previous generation hardware running off of a disc? That part really angers me. But still, what can I say? It's Little Big Planet. If you like Little Big Planet, Little Big Planet 3, it's PS4 version of it. Move the next generation. Actually, you know what? Earlier I said that Infamous Second Son was my favorite console exclusive for PS4. I lied. It's Little Big Planet 3. It is short. It had issues. It did crash a few times. But it was really fun. It's type of game that I just like. It makes me feel like a little kid, and sometimes I want that because I'm an adult, and sometimes that's not fun. So feeling like a kid, same reason I like the Tearaway. I just felt like a kid playing it. So I guess there's also one other, The Dear God, which was a Kickstarter game I backed. I did a full playthrough on Indie Showcase, my live show that goes on when it's not holiday season on Thursdays. And it's a procedurally generated kind of Metroidvania where you play a hunter who was getting ready to kill a deer. A bunch of wolves attacked him. He died and got reincarnated as a deer. The game, it feels like you're playing as a deer. You move fast. You jump great. You have to survive against hunters and wolves and mountain lions. Other animals won't hurt you, like deers and rabbits will be your friends. It's really cool. It has a reincarnation system where if you die and you've been doing evil things, evil being attacking and killing deer, attacking and killing any type of animal that doesn't wish harm on you, you'll pick up evil karma. And if you die and get reincarnated while evil, you may come back as a snake or something like that, which will have less power and none of your deer abilities. If you are good, you'll be reincarnated as a deer. And the deer abilities include things like double jump, a sort of headbutt attack with your antlers, different things like that. You also pick up magic through solving these puzzles. And the magics, if you're evil, will include things like fireballs or blizzards or, you know, things that will cause damage. If you're good, they'll involve things like a healing spell, a teleport spell. Spells that'll let you interact with the environment more, like grow vines that you could jump up on. It's a really cool game. It's a lot of fun. It's procedurally generated where you're going to have a set of possible things that'll come up based on how far you progressed in the story. And as you move from left to right, you'll come across different events repeating until you finish them. So at one point, for example, you had to kill a giant turtle that was, evil or something. So if you don't kill the giant turtle and keep going, eventually you'll come back upon that giant turtle. Some things you'll find at all places. There'll be different shrines where you can learn magic if you solve a puzzle. There'll be female deer you'll encounter from time to time that you can mate with. And if you die, you come back as your offspring. If you don't mate and you die, you don't have a checkpoint, permadeath. Luckily, it does give you a lot of chances for not facing permadeath, including there's an item system where you could use like mushrooms to create a giant mushroom that you could use as like a trampoline. There's, items that let you move quicker, jump higher, jump further, attack stronger for a while, be immune to damage for a while. It's really cool. It's really fun. And the visual style, it's pixels in a very unique way of multi-layers of pixels. You only move in one layer, but there's a layer in front of you that will include trees that will kind of block your view a little bit. There's a layer behind you, and the pixels on the different layers get smaller as they go in the background. So it has this really, really cool pixel look to it. It's got to be one of the best games I've played. It's available on Steam now. It's early access, so there's actually no ending to the game, as far as I know. But it's a lot of fun, and it's the type of game where I gave it to my mother for Christmas, and she doesn't do action games all that much, and she was happy to tell me yesterday how she beat the game. So, you know, it's the type of game that could reach a lot of different audiences, and it could bring in non-action people to what is essentially an action game. The only thing that's kind of disappointing is, besides no ending yet, the game, it can be a little difficult because you have a food meter, so you have to keep eating as you go along, and some puzzles will take a while to figure out how to solve, And by the time you finally figure out how to solve them, you realize, well, I've got to get going because I'm about out of food. I'm going to starve to death if I don't, you know, leave right now. But since everything's procedurally generated, you could just leave, find some food, and come back a little bit later, and all is well. So it's not too punishing. So now I want to get into a subset of games. Or actually, no, I have a couple other I did not bring up. First off, Valiant Hearts, which came from UbiArt, the Ubisoft kind of indie-ish studio. It was more or less a point-and-click adventure game, but it was all about World War I. You play multiple characters, including an American who is serving in the French army, a French farmer who has a tragic story of his daughter was married to a German, and they're living in France. The son, the German, was kicked out of the country when war began because, you know, people in World War I, if you were not from that country but from the other side, they're going to view you as treason in the making. So he's sent home, home in a sense, to Germany to serve on the German side. And the farmer, he gets enlisted to serve on the French side. So he's facing off against his son-in-law. There's the American, who is just a big, tough black guy, and he is really badass. Frankie, I think, was his name. And then there was the Belgian nurse, who she just wanted to go out and help people in the war. Those who were injured, she wanted to help keep them alive. And then also she's looking for her father, who was conscripted by the Germans to be a scientific genius to make weapons of war. And then you also have a dog who will join you eventually, who kind of solves puzzles for you. So you might see a tunnel you can't fit through with a switch in it. So you'll tell the dog to throw the switch for you. The game is heartbreaking. It takes place in World War I, which no one won. No one won in that war. And my advice is, if you play that game, the very final chapter of it will make you very sad. It will break your heart completely. And it's a great game. It's a great adventure game. Like I said earlier, I don't do point-and-click adventure anymore, and that's one I couldn't stop playing because the World War I setting for it was just epic, just amazing. And yeah, all I could say is it is a brilliant point-and-click adventure game. Although not really point-and-click, more of walk your guy around and click, but you know what I'm saying. Then, let's see, there was, Middle-Earth, Tales of Middle-Earth, Beyond Middle-Earth, Shadow of Mordor. Or I guess it'd be Middle-Earth, Shadow of Mordor. That's the proper name. Or as everyone called it, Shadows of Mordor. Even though it was not Shadows, it was Shadow of Mordor. So Shadow of Mordor is an open-world-ish game. You've probably heard plenty about it by now. It takes place, you're a ranger who is, this all takes place between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. You're a ranger whose family was murdered, and you get possessed by a wraith or a spirit who wants revenge, and to know what his history was, you want revenge against the orcs who were responsible for killing your family. If it wasn't for one system, it'd be kind of a nondescript, kind of fun but pointless third-person action open-world game. The thing that made it really cool was the nemesis system. So the nemesis system, if an orc captain killed you, he would remember you when you came back to life. So part of the theme of the game is you are the undying one. You will be killed and you will come back. And when an orc captain kills you, he'll get promoted, he'll gain strength. Plus, also, he's going to end up remembering you. So first time you meet an orc captain, he might, you know, just snarl at you and be like, oh, you're the ranger, you're the undying one, I will kill you. If he kills you and you come back later, he'll be like, oh, you couldn't take enough the first time. And you'll end up having, like, rivalries with these orc captains who are just random, as far as I could tell, randomly generated from a few different sets of potential names and abilities. They'll have different weaknesses and strengths, so one orc captain may be immune to stealth finishers, so you can't sneak up and try and assassinate them. Another one's going to be weak to ranged attacks, so you just find a spot to snipe him from far away and pick him off, and he'll never know what happened. Some of them are strong to almost everything, and you're left with really weird ways to kill them, like maybe they're strong to everything except poison. So you need to sneak into their stronghold, poison their grog, and wait for them to drink from it, and then die. So it's a really cool, like, that. The nemesis system, the captains, it's all really cool. When you kill an orc captain, he might come back again. You might not have fully killed him off. Eventually, some will die. In fact, eventually, I think it's like if you kill them about three or so times, you can expect they're probably going to be dead. But they'll remember you, and they will swear at you. They will want revenge. They'll track you down sometimes. You'll be out in the middle of nowhere, and all of a sudden you'll hear, "At last, I found you. I will get revenge." And so it makes you really invested into a game that essentially the story is kind of crap. It's really cool how it works that way. It's an addictive game. It's fun to collect all the collectibles. I have to say, I'm a little less than halfway through, but I did put in a lot of time just going through getting the collectibles. I mean, it is addictive. And I think part of the reason I haven't finished the game, I haven't played in about a month, is it's so addictive. If I start playing, I'm going to lose all of my time to that game. I don't have enough time to be able to give up like 4 hours at a time before I go, oh crap, I've been playing 4 hours, I need to fucking quit already. So, really good game, really addictive, I really need to finish it. It is beautiful, the visuals are amazing. And yeah, if you like third-person hack and slash action and open world, it's a good game for you. If you like collectibles, it's a good game for you. If you like great visuals, it's a good game for you. If you finally wanted a licensed Lord of the Rings or Middle Earth game and you wanted it good, this is a perfect game for you. Because this is the only Lord of the Rings related game I know of that is not, in my opinion, a steaming pile of shit. Next up, okay, this one kind of, let's just say this game in some ways was involved in starting the biggest shitstorm there is in video game related stuff. Depression Quest. And let me just say, as somebody who has dealt with issues of depression, this game is amazing. It's pretty much a interactive, narrative. You play someone with depression who is battling to overcome it, battling survive against their own psyche, and the approach the game takes is almost entirely text-based. There's a little bit of background sounds and background music, and a still picture for each event that you deal with, and it is a great experience. If you know someone with depression and you don't suffer from it yourself, you should try playing Depression Quest. It's a free game on Steam, and it really does, it helps to introduce you to the way somebody might cope with or be unable to cope with their depression. It's a beautiful experience, and I think anyone who has a problem with Zoe Quinn or with Depression Quest, they just are not getting it. This shows that it's not all about bro gamers and all that crap. It is, there is a chance for video games to go deeper, to be more socially responsible, to really help explain important issues. Same way I felt about Valiant Hearts. It taught about World War I. Yes, it wasn't 100% like putting you in the mind of it, but Depression Quest kind of does that. You know, games, I think this year showed you could really have education based off of them. All right, so next off, I realized I do have a game of the year. I do have one I can honestly call my game of the year. But before I even bring that game up, I want to talk about Infinite Lives, Infinite Deaths. That was my showcase of me playing through or giving up on really hard games. Games meant to cause pain, cause to make you suffer. So let's start with Dust Force, which I really wanted to like this one, but the controls never felt right. You play a guy with a broom. Essentially, you're trying just to get to the end of each stage, like a lot of Meat Boy-ish type of games are. But you had movements that include you could run on ceilings, you could run up walls, you could do wall jumps. It felt floaty, and trying to get the ceiling running working never worked. I just felt like the controls were not correctly made for this game. And then you have a huge open area for your stage select, and it's hard to figure out where the fuck do I go for a new level. Because once you find a level, there's an area you could go to just instantly teleport to that level. But until you find a level, it's like, where do I go to find more levels right now? Is it up, down, left, right? Is it that weird side passage? Where do I fucking go? And that kind of breaks the experience for me. Combined with the awkward controls, I just felt like the game was a chore. So, yeah, Dust Force, it was not an amazing experience. And speaking of non-amazing experiences, Closure. It was a game it took me forever to track down because it's a weird one-word name that doesn't really explain what the game is. It's not about finding, like, I could see something like Depression Quest being called Closure. I could see something like Valiant Hearts being called Closure. Closure sounds like emotional, you know, coming together of emotional problems. Instead, it's about light and dark. You'll play a guy who will pretty much pick up light orbs, and anywhere there is light, you could see what the floors and walls look like. Anywhere where there is dark, there is literally no floors and no walls. And it's a real cool idea, but the problem is, while I like the idea of the game, there were some ways the activating lights in certain areas didn't work correctly. It felt like there was a lack of polish. So, yeah, I can't recommend Closure. Another one I can't really recommend, Bit Trip Runner. I say that only for one reason. It's a non-endless runner. It's a runner you go from start to the end of a level, and then you go the next level. It's a fun game in its own right. I never played it until this year, and it is fun, but the visuals are really bad. It's going for a retro visual style, but it is so retro, the visuals hurt my eyes. Like, literally, that game was giving me eye strain. And then there's the fact that the controls feel kind of slow and weird. It's almost like a prototype of Bit Trip, of what becomes Bit Trip Presents Runner 2, The Legend of Rhythm Alien. Which, that one is an awesome game. The visuals are great. The controls are great. The game is addictive. The boss battles are the best boss battles I've done on any live stream. They're fun. There's a lot of checkpoints, so you never feel punished for failing. You just feel like, okay, the game's saying I've got to do a little better, and I should. So, Bit Trip Presents Runner 2, The Legend of Rhythm Alien, is just an amazing game. It has great humor in the cutscenes. It feels like a weird Saturday morning cartoon type of experience. It has retro nostalgia levels. It has everything. Next up, Phoenix Rage. It was really cool, very Meat Boy-ish. You could move freely. You could jump repeatedly in the air. So it's kind of a double jump, but it's an infinite jump. You could kind of do a speed dash in the air or on the ground, left and right. And just like with Super Meat Boy, it's all about getting to the end of a level, surviving against spikes and, you know, obstacles that'll kill you. And you collect cookie recipes. And those are the collectibles. And if you find all of the cookie recipes in a world, you're going to have actual recipes for cookies. I don't know why, but it's kind of cool. I kind of want to try out some of these recipes. The one downside is, unlike Bit Trip Presents Runner 2, The boss battles in Phoenix Rage sucked. They just sucked the life out of what could have been an amazing game. When I played it, it was on my old computer on Infinite Lives, Infinite Deaths. And then I got my studio and one of the few games on Steam, at least at a time, that didn't have cloud saves. And the only reason I didn't try going through it again is I didn't want to face the two bosses I beat. I beat two bosses. I never want to fucking see those bosses again. I'm done with them. Speaking of being done with a game, that was N1 Spikes. It feels kind of cool when you first start off. It's another get to the end of the level, you know, like a lot of these games are. You explore a small area and you avoid spikes and platforms. And there's a lot more than 1,001 spikes in that game. There are a shit ton of spikes. And you have, like, I don't know, kind of a Indiana Jones-ish vibe in a way with this game, which is kind of pretty cool. And by that, I mean, you're exploring old temples. You have statues in the walls that are shooting, darts out of their mouths. Like, you feel like you're Indiana Jones in sort of a pixelated, hard-as-shit game. The one downside is, near the end, I start to face some levels that went from being fun to being tedious. And by that, I mean, a lot of these games that are great for Infinite Lives, Infinite Deaths, you just dive into the game. You run in, and you keep running, and you learn how to avoid things, how to get through. Some of the later levels on 1001 Spikes are a lot about, okay, you need wait. And you need to wait possibly up to a minute for a platform to get to the correct place. For all of the statues shooting darts to shoot in the correct synchronicity. Wow, that's a great word to try and say when I'm sick. I blame you, NyQuil. But you have to wait. And waiting makes for a boring live stream. I mean, wait for 2 minutes and then, oh, you fucked up. Okay, wait for 2 minutes on your new life and, oh, you messed up. Wait for 2 minutes and I quit. I mean, it could have been great, but the later levels just sucked the life out of that game. So, I'd give BitTrip Presents Runner 2 Legend of Rhythm Alien the second place for Infinite Lives, Infinite Deaths games. My first place, Super Meat Boy. Never played it until this year, and I don't think I would have played it if it wasn't for having a live stream called Infinite Lives, Infinite Deaths. It is fucking amazing. It is the best, one of the best experiences I've had playing a game. Every level is perfectly fair and perfectly hard. They never give you a chance to feel comfortable, but they never make it where you feel like the game is uncomfortable and unfair and just wants you dead. It is a lot of fun. It's not my type of game, but I'm really glad I have Infinite Lives, Infinite Deaths to make me play this game. It's the most rewarding experience I had all year. It was so difficult. And every time I beat a level, I felt like I accomplished everything in the world I ever need to accomplish. Game's old, the game's fun, the game is just great. I guess I forgot one or two games, one of which I forgot. I'm going to go ahead and mention, even though I just named my best game, but Team Indie. Team Indie is a puzzle platformer that kind of has same vibe as a lot of indie puzzle platformers in the Infinite Lives, Infinite Death style. And they do a lot of fan service. You could select a lot of different characters. You get to see Captain Video or Commander Video from BitTrip Runner. You get to see, like, different characters from a bunch of indie games, hence the name Team Indie. It's a team of indie characters coming together, solve puzzles, and have the worst fucking controls I've ever seen in a game, and not fun of puzzles. So, yeah, let's just pretend Team Indie never existed. And so, my game of the year, now that I remember, I do have one, as I scroll through my list of games I played, my game of the year ties in once again to how Bree got me a Vita. And one of the things with Vita, I knew it was coming, and I started collecting PS Plus free games, or free if you're on PS Plus. One of them I got was Thomas Was Alone. I'm not sure how old this game is, but it's a puzzle platformer. You start off controlling Thomas. Every character is supposed to be a fragment of an AI system that is considered rogue and is being deleted. Thomas is a tall rectangle that is red. And the narration is brilliant in this game. The narration begins, Thomas was alone. And Thomas starts to learn, oh, look, I could jump. I can fall. I want to go and find new things. And he's going through different puzzles, jumping and falling through different obstacles. But then, later on, you start finding more people. There's, I believe it's Jonathan, who is a tall, tall rectangle, can jump higher than Thomas, but he can't get through so many passages because he's too tall. There's Claire, who's a blue square, who starts off on a platform with nowhere to go because there's water all around her, and water is death in this world. The platform starts to crumble, and she accepts her fate of she's going to die, but she was useless anyways. Then she learns she can float in water and survive, and decides she's a superhero, and she's going to go forth and find more people to save them from water. There's so many of these different characters. They're all different, like, squares and rectangles. There's, I forget his name. One of them who's really grumpy. I think it might be Christopher. Is a little grumpy square. And he's short. He can't jump that high. But then he finds a flat, pinkish rectangle who serves as a trampoline. And they become boyfriend-girlfriend. It just... it's charming. It is fun. The puzzles are great. Most of all, it's charming. The narrations are brilliant. What's great is when the narrator will say, saying like, Thomas realized, hey, I'm pretty good at this jumping thing. You know, he'll change. The narrator is the only voice, but he'll change his tone of voice. I played through the game all the way on Vita. Vita version's great. I don't know if they included DLC or not, as in if you can get DLC, but the Steam version has two additional chapters that felt like DLC with new characters. However, the Vita version had a, like, director's commentary you could put on where he explains where these ideas were coming from. It's just a brilliant game, and it's a game to play when you're feeling kind of down, because these characters just make you feel happy. They make you feel great. And when they start to face their, impending doom of being deleted as this AI is formatted away by its creators, and you'll learn about the AI in between chapters and some levels, each chapter of which there are 10 in the Vita version, 12 on the Steam version. Each one consists of 10 levels, which is essentially one stage. And in between chapters, you'll get messages from the, programmers of this AI talking about how they've detected rogue fragments of memory, which would be Thomas and his friends. It's really cool. It's really simple. It is a ton of fun. And it's a game I can't stop going back to. I've been playing it for over a year because I started playing it last year shortly after Christmas. And I played it again on Christmas Day. So, I mean, I've been playing this game that I've beaten twice. Once on Vita, once on PC, and then some. And I'm still playing the game. I am still loving it. It's fun. It's innocent. It's nothing short of brilliant. So, yeah, Thomas Was Alone. That's my game of the year. It's not from this year, but it's my game of the year. Oh, I suppose I should throw in there's one other game I played, and this is for anime fans out there. I only started playing this game today. However, I have 3 hours on it. This was a birthday gift from John. He got me off of Steam, Naruto Shippuden Ultimate Ninja Storm Revolution, which is the latest Naruto game. It's pretty cool. If you're a Naruto fan, it's a lot of fun. The game is based primarily around the Champions Tournament, where it's essentially all of the Naruto people, past, present, all of them, are brought together to compete to see who the best ninja is. And there is little side quests in between. There's, a bunch of little silly things that you could do. You could talk to people. You could buy items that you could then use in combat. You could customize your character. So the game starts off where you could choose who you want to be, and there's about a couple dozen characters. And so the three of the choices you get at beginning are Naruto, Naruto in Sage mode, and Naruto in his Awakened Ninetales mode, where he's glowing. Obviously, I picked that one. If you're a fan of the show, yeah, he's brokenly badass at that point. So I picked him, and you go through, like, you have to find people who you could befriend to be your teammates, and they'll unlock new characters play as later on. And so, like, one of the first things I had was a little side quest where it was, Guy training Team Guy. And so the first part of it was you're asked to help out, so it's you battling against one of Guy's students. Then after that, you have a race to a beach, and then you have to fight another one of his students. You have a race somewhere else. You have to fight his third student. So you go through fighting Rock, Ten-Ten, and Neji. And then at the final race, none of the students show up, so it's you versus Guy. And that'll unlock, like, your, you know, they'll unlock those four as teammates. You have different battle types, so there's one battle type, which is kind of dumb that they love to use, is called the Orb Battle or the four-player battle. In it, it's a free-for-all, four versus, you know, four people, one-on-one-on-one-on-one. And you beat each other up, and as you get knocked around, the more damage you take or someone takes, they'll knock orbs out of themselves. You start with 1,000 orbs. And your goal is, when the timer is done, you want to have more orbs than any other team. And it's, it's okay. It's a lot of fighting. It's a lot of chaos. If you beat someone down to zero orbs and then hit them again, they're out of the tournament. And it's okay. It's fun if you like simple, quick button-mashing combat. But then there's also the team battles, where it's going to be you and one or two ninjas who you are teamed up with as your support versus somebody else who has support. And you could call in your support people by hitting the left bumper or right bumper. They'll come in. Like, I was doing, when I fought Guy, it was Naruto teamed up with support from Kakashi and Yamato. So I could call in Kakashi, and he'd show up and do a lightning attack on Guy. And it's anime silliness, but it's pretty fun. The main story is not as good as last year's Naruto game, which I forget what it's called, Ultimate Ninja Storm Deluxe or something, which that one covered the story, essentially, of the series. Meanwhile, this one has this Tournament of Champions, which is kind of dumb, but it's still fun. And then it has Ninja Escapades, which is sort of little mini story modes that'll show story that was not on the manga or on the anime, but was alluded to. So the first one is the founding of Akashi. I am not pronouncing anything worth a shit. Founding of the Evil Group. So you start off as Pain, and you slowly go around gathering the different people who would end up being Akashi. I'm not even going to try and pronounce that name. It's impossible to pronounce when NyQuil is my co-pilot. But it all gives you a chance to see the story behind what they alluded to in the anime and manga. It's really cool. It's fully voice acted. You could select English voices or Japanese voices. You could select subtitles or no subtitles. I'm doing Japanese voices with subtitles because I can't understand Japanese beyond like three words. And overall, it's a great experience. The Ninja Escapades is a lot of fun. And if you're an anime or if you're a Naruto fan, it's really cool to go through. And so price of it is like around $60. Steam sale knocked it down quite a bit. I don't think I'd honestly pay more than 20. Last year's Naruto game, I would pay, and I did pay, $50 for it. And I'd say it was slightly better, although the new one, you get more characters. I think there's more versions of each character. So on this one, you know, you have Naruto, Naruto in Sage mode, Naruto in the Awaken Nine Tails mode. Plus, also, you could change costumes, change what special abilities you have, you know, change what your main ninjutsu attack, your super attack is. You could change out what your more minor ones are. It's a lot of button mashing, but there's a lot of, I don't know, a lot of cool things to see. It's anime fan service, and it's fun. It's not too difficult. The only downside is, on the note of difficultness, the game does not have, like, the tutorial intro battle thing. You go look at tutorials that will be text-based telling you how to do things, but you're not going to have a chance before you start fighting in the tournament. You're not going to have a chance to learn what the controls are. It never tells you, you know, okay, we're going to learn how to jump. We're going to learn how to attack. We're going to learn how to block. No, it's just going to throw you into it. So luckily, it's not too hard to start. Some of the battles get a little tricky. Some of them in the Ninja Escapade mode have special requirements for how you could finish it to get bonus equipment and bonus items. But you're never going to really have a chance to learn. So take those easy battles as a chance to learn the controls as best you can. Once you learn them, they're not too bad until you figure out what you're doing. Like I said, I played for 3 hours. A good amount of that was not fighting. I've probably done about 20 or so fights. And I have to say, I'm still kind of learning the controls. I've got most of it down, but some of it still learning. Still, if I had to say I had an anime game of the year, that would be Naruto Shippuden Ultimate Ninja Storm Revolution. If I had an indie or Infinite Lives, Infinite Deaths game of the year, that'd be Super Meat Boy, hands down, followed by Bit Trip Presents Runner 2, The Legend of Rhythm Alien, followed last of all by Phoenix Rage in third place. If it didn't have its boss fights, it'd be a tough one between that and Bit Trip Presents Runner 2. Meat Boy, though, Super Meat Boy is too perfect of a game. It wins every competition for that type of game. If I had to say best multiplayer game of a year, I'd go with, depending on the mood, if you want something slow and thought-inducing, The Yogg, amazing choose-your-own-adventure game. If you wanted something just goofy as hell, Gang Beasts. And if you wanted something less goofy and more of just free-for-all kick each other's ass, Smash Brothers for Wii U. If you wanted the best phone or mobile game, Monument Valley. Best portable game that is entirely portable would be The Tearaway for Vita. Best RPG, South Park, Stick of Truth. And the best licensed product, followed number 2 on licensed product by Shadow of Mordor. Best game, though, of the year, Thomas Was Alone. I mean, fuck, that game's so good. And if it wasn't on Steam, it'd also be my portable game of the year. I'm not sure if it's on, like, PS3 or anything. But the only systems I know for sure it's on are Vita and Steam. I'm too lazy to look things up. So anyways, 2014 is a crappy year for a lot of things, but at least there were some real cool games, and for me, some old games I never knew about before. So, yeah, 2014, you did pretty good on games. Now, if only you could get away from the whole Gamergate bullshit for 2015. That's my wish for a new year. No more Gamergate. Hopefully, you can all be with me on that one. Anyways, thanks for listening to Preposterous Gamer number 12. This was December 31st, 2014, which meant the right time to announce Game of the Year from the Preposterous Gamer perspective. Thanks for listening. Have a happy new year.